or at lifelock.com.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie, and Arlene Englehart, with her broken leg, has gotten good news. She can finally put about 50% weight on that, so her recovery should be speeded up quite a bit. And before you know it, she'll be back in here with me. But I'm very excited about the show today. But actually, I'm pretty worried. Dorian, you know, if you combine Michael last year, who raced through and just devastated, but raced through, and then compare it to Dorian this year, the devastation of Hurricane 5, and actually coming to a standstill. And I cannot imagine the devastation. I can't imagine what the people in the Bahamas have gone through, what they're still going through. And I don't know if you watched any of the town hall last night about climate change. I think the best moment actually was Bernie Sanders when he says we spend trillions every year just to try and defend or destroy each other. We've got to pool our resources, and we do, people. Climate change is not only real, but just look at Dorian. And just think, what would you have done? I still can't imagine the terrible suffering those people went through and are going to continue to go through. And unfortunately, we can expect these storms to get worse and worse. And you know that we look in the mirror. If we need an enemy to declare a war, we have been declaring war on nature for years. And she doesn't need us. She will adjust to some of the stuff we do, and adjustments won't be to our liking. They might not even be to our survivability. And so when you were listening to that debate last night, and particularly Sanders and Warren, they're into it. They know it. They have different philosophies, but they realize how real it is. The time is for change. And we've really reached a moment in our history, not just in this country, but the planet. And we either respond, and I think that in spite of all the horrors and the concerns, I think we're up to it. I think we've got some of the finest young people I have ever dealt with. They're smart. They're passionate, and they realize they understand the rock and the hard place. So anyway, people, look in the mirror. That's the enemy. If you need one, it's all of us. It's all of us, what we haven't done, what we have been doing to destroy and not really be concerned about the planet and the needs and the responsibilities of us all. But Dorian still continues to turn away, and so it's up to us. And I really honestly feel if we really put our heads to it and our hearts, we can do it. But there are no guarantees. So anyway, I'm really excited about the show this week. First, we're going to be talking about something that's kind of similar, if you will. Nestle's proposal to take 1.1 million gallons from Jenny Springs every day. But hey, not to worry, because they've got this whole sustainability of water down, and they can handle it. We shall see. I'm going to be talking to Marilee Marwitz-Gibson and Dr. Michael Lynch, and they're going to give their opinions on the issue. And then in the second hour, we'll be talking to Julie Kohler from Democracy Alliance. And she, in recent polling data, is revealing that the Republicans have quite a problem with white women. And so we will have to follow that. So, okay, I'm going to put this music on, and we will come back with Marilee Marwitz-Gibson and Dr. Michael Lynch.
Don't skill, without a long, don't count.
because I am so excited with the guests we have, because that's, I know it's an issue that all of you are really going to be interested in. And we have Marilee Marowicz-Gibson, and Marilee is actually part of our Santa Fe River, and she's also on the Santa Fe River Board. She's a member. And so, Marilee Marowicz-Gibson, welcome so much to the show.
Thank you, Mary. Good to be with you all.
And we also have Dr. Michael Lynch with us, and he's a professor of criminology at University of South Florida. He has a PhD from School of Criminal Justice, State University of New York in Albany. But he's the founder of a criminological subfield of research called green criminology. And I believe in 1990, he was the first one to write a book about that. And with all that's happening with climate change and everything else, I think that is a field that we really need to investigate. He's the author or editor of 18 books. He's authored more than 120 ground articles and 50 book chapters. This has been a very, very busy man, and he's received two awards, actually pretty outstanding awards for his achievements. And I could probably read more of his accolades for the rest of the hour. But Dr. Michael Lynch, also welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, Marilee, Nestle, the proposal for Ginny Springs, 1.1 million gallons a day. This is absolutely, to me, shocking, because at least the last statistics I saw, that actually just Florida people in all of their multi-uses of agriculture and our own personal use and lawns and everything else, that we actually are not allowing the aquifer to replenish each day as is. And Nestle wants to take 1.1 million gallons from Ginny Springs. What's this about?
Yeah, so Nestle is trying to secure an existing water use permit that was issued years ago, before we had the science that we have today, before we have the depletion of the aquifer issues that we have today. And so they're working with a private family called, the business name of the family is called Seven Springs Bottling Partnership. They're the ones that actually secured the permit. They are related to the Ginny Springs campground that everybody up, at least in North Florida, knows. We all love Ginny Springs. We all enjoy the clear, fresh spring waters there. And the bore wells that are on the campground's property are directly connected to the bottling plant. Years ago, when we thought we were the Saudi Arabia of fresh water in the world, in North Florida, bottling operations were popping up all over the place in rural areas. And this was one of them. It was a scheme, of course, to get rich. Get rich on fresh water. Next, we'll be selling oxygen and air to breathe. But in the meantime, this permit is existing. And so at no point in time during the three previous bottling operations that had been located here in this this facility off of County Road 340 in High Springs, Gilchrist County, High Springs, at no point in time had any of those operations ever bottled 1,152,000 gallons a day. And Nestle intends to not only bottle this water, but also bulk transfer container trucks to Madison Blue Springs, which is in the north end of Florida, and also to the Zephyr Hills plant, which is more toward Tampa. For their bottling needs, because at these other locations, they have problems with their water. Just like everybody in the state of Florida, we all have problems with water. Why are we bottling it when we should be protecting it as a finite resource, not as an infinite resource as we used to think water was? So as a result of this existing permit, it shouldn't be issued, because we are seeing declines in the Santa Fe River. We're seeing declines in the springs. We're seeing impaired waterways. There is no point scientifically to issue this finite resource, our fresh water, for you and for me. The Florida Aquifer feeds 22 million people. So basically, Nestle is just taking the water from us and selling it back to us in plastic.
Plastic bottles, no less. But call me stupid, but I guess I'm a little confused by this. That the permit, why isn't Nestle applying for the permit themselves? I mean, why are they going through this Seven Springs, which had it prior? And what, has that run out, or has that been renewed? And what is the deal with Nestle needing a middleman here?
So historically, that's how permits have been issued in the state of Florida. Somebody owns land, and because they own the property, they believe that they have rights to whatever is above and below the property. And in this case, there's private landowners that owned the land, applied for a permit, roughly $120 permit 20 years ago. These bottled water permits only last 20 years, and then they have to be renewed. At least our Florida legislators and water managers back in the day understood that renewals were important and necessary in case things changed, which they have. Our natural resources need more protection than what we're giving them. And so it's only a 20-year permit that was issued. And why didn't Nestle go and buy their own land and go through the process of trying to secure their own well water? Well, they would be faced with the same backlash they're seeing now, and it would be a lot harder to get a permit. This, because it has been existing, is a lot easier to just transfer and pay Seven Springs for that water use. They don't pay the state of Florida. They pay the private landowner that money per gallon. We don't know how much money. We've never seen the contract for that, but we are certain that they pay Seven Springs for this water that technically is all of our water resources. So this is a common business practice in the state of Florida. This permit is not the only bottled water permit in the state. There are probably over 30 known permits that exist in every water management district as a totality. There are close to that many. And that's generally what happens is a private landowner owns the land. And as we face any kind of mining or any kind of land water degradation, the one that owns the land gets to do whatever they want above and below it. And so, yeah.
Well, but I guess I'm really missing the main point here. I don't know how you can own water. Water isn't just in one place. Water flows, you know, regularly up and down and eventually out to the Gulf or to the ocean. So how can you own water when it's constantly moving? I thought water was a public resource that actually couldn't be owned by anybody, so thus you can't charge for it. But so how can a landowner, being you own some land where the water might flow by it or under it, maybe you could say at that particular moment in time you could have that water, but how I don't get it, how you can own water.
Right. So it's written into Florida statutes that bottled water in our state is allowable. And you'd have to read the water resource manual, the handbook, on how it is managed and how you can actually purvey water through a well and sell it. Florida statutes need to be addressed the way our laws and regulations are written in the state of Florida. It allows people to bottle water and sell it, and also for free. The fact that has no cost to get per gallon out of a bore well and then turn around and sell it also needs to be addressed in the legislature or in the water management. Probably legislature, the laws and rules need to be written. They were written years ago before we knew any better, before we have the problems that we have today.
And I want to bring you into this discussion, Dr. Lynch, because to me, this is green criminology. I do not understand how one landowner can own water. And to me, for a company to be able to take this water and put it in plastic bottles, and we're aware now that our plastic problem has reached the level that actually all of us are breathing in plastic particles because we are plasticizing the earth with dire consequences. To me, should be a crime that you can own water.
Well, I think you're thinking of it like you own the water, and what people own is the access rights to the resources under their property. So they don't necessarily own the water, but they own the ability to access what's there, right? And all underground resources are really like this in the United States. You can think of oil or gas wells, you know, natural gas wells, and there's just a long history of allowing corporate access to things that are held in common. And part of the problem here becomes the corporations are really getting something for free, which they're not paying for. So, for example, I think Merrily was saying that the permit cost the people who own it now a few hundred dollars. Well, they're pumping more than a few hundred dollars worth of water out of the aquifer. And, you know, if you as citizens really own the water. Shouldn't you be compensated at a better rate than that and have your water preserved by having higher rates of water cost?
But also, shouldn't it be in the permitting process? Is this really in the public's best interest? I mean, is it in anybody's best interest to have water that we need for our own purposes here to be actually put in plastic bottles that are such an enormous problem and cost to the environment totally? Is this really in the public's best interest? And does the public have any say here to challenge that?
Well, it's never really in the public interest to give away the resources that you own in common. But one of the things that governments do is they arrange to give away your commonly owned resources to corporations that profit off of the access to those resources and their resale. This is a hugely centuries-long tradition of this occurring. And the only way that these things get stopped is that people in the general public become involved. And, you know, part of being involved is knowing what's going on in your state and not voting for people who believe that these are appropriate environmental policies.
And I know this really wouldn't apply necessarily to the specific thing of taking water from the Santa Fe River, Ginny Springs, but Nestle has such a past, and I'm thinking of what the zombie, the permit they had in the San Bernardino Valley, which is it's just desertized out there, and there they were removing almost 500,000 gallons of water through the desert, and but even more so, I guess I first became involved in knowing about Nestle's practices with discouraging breastfeeding, particularly with African women, when here in America, women were going back to breastfeeding, and so they needed new markets. And so there, they went into Africa en masse and, you know, were saying all this. And, you know, with the lack of potable water and with so much lactose intolerance there, to me, it was scandalous. And then they went into their chocolate. I haven't had a Nestle's chocolate bar of any kind for years because of the slave and the child labor. And so Nestle really kind of seems to know how to get around these things. And to me, it kind of reminds me of the zombie permit they had in San Bernardino.
Yes, well, the question is, are they really getting around it or are they actually violating the law and not necessarily getting caught all that often? They have a very, if you read, you know, various websites on the internet, they have a very bad international reputation. So with all of these issues you're bringing up, it's a company that is always, you know, all the concern is the company and not really the public. And this is, you know, kind of a big issue now when we're talking about destroying ecosystems. And as you destroy ecosystems, you destroy obviously the planet around you and the lives of people. But, you know, for these corporations, what they care about is the profit involved and not really the people who, you know, I don't know if we can say they're serving people or are they disserving people at this point.
Well, and that's why I think your whole venture with green criminology and at USF, I think this is wonderful, really, because as Marilee was just saying, that the public's involvement is way behind what we need in not only our best interest, but Marilee, you really love the Santa Fe River. You obviously really love to be on the water and the outdoors. Some of the most important freshwater turtles, I mean, tell us a little about these really precious springs. And as I understand, Dr. Knight has been doing a report on the Springs Institute, and Ginny Springs and most of our pretty well-known springs are not grading very well at all. They're in pretty bad shape. And so, number one, tell us about some of the many species of freshwater turtles and other amphibians and mammals, birds, etc., that Ginny Springs and other springs really has.
Yeah, so there's a project called the Santa Fe River Turtle Project. It's easy to find online. Dr. Jerry Johnston from Santa Fe College is doing research with his students out on the river often to track and identify the 11 well-known species that habit our waterways. There's some of the most unique turtle populations in the whole world. I think it's second or third in the world as far as how many or how abundant our turtle population is. And the degradation that you're speaking to with the research that's being done at the Florida Springs Institute, which is under Dr. Bob Knight's leadership, we're seeing that in a roughly 11-mile stretch or 15-mile stretch, I think it is, of the Santa Fe River, we have the highest abundance of freshwater springs, more springs in that stretch of the waterway than anywhere in the entire world in terms of proximity in that stretch of water. And so from the start of the stretch, where we've had an abundance of freshwater springs pouring out of the aquifer, we're seeing declines at, for instance, Treehouse, Hornsby Springs. We're seeing declines at Poe Springs on down the river. Now at Rum Island Spring, we're seeing declines. And the next springs that we're seeing declines are at Blue, and Ginny will be next in line, because it seems that they're depleting from the beginning of this stretch all the way down. And it's indicative of the Floridan Aquifer, which has been seeing 20 feet below normal, whatever normal is in this day and age with our freshwater resources. But historically, with the data set that we've been able to identify in the last 1940s, we're seeing that our aquifer is 20 feet below, quote-unquote, normal. Now, in the past 3 years or so, we've been seeing high rains, heavy rains, so we've had a little bit of increase in our aquifer because it is a recharge system. Where we live in this part of Florida, it is the recharge for the Floridan. So we're seeing a little bit of uptick, but historical records show that graph as a steady decline. So in terms of the habitat, we also have prize-winning bass that are on our waterways. We also have alligators. Of course, we have manatees that come up into this stretch. Historically, we've had fossilized manatee bones that have been found in and along the river, so we know that historically this has been a migratory waterway for the manatee that comes in out of the Gulf of Mexico up the Suwannee and into this stretch of the Santa Fe. We have seen more than normal migration of manatees recently because the river levels have been a little bit higher. They're influenced again by rain conditions. So we're seeing manatees coming up here in larger population amounts. They definitely go into the Itchituckney. The Itchituckney is a tributary into the Santa Fe River. And so knowing that that endangered and threatened species is up in our reaches is also important and significant in terms of habitat. With all of that being said, we had a cyanobacteria event on our river in 2012, and much like the rest of the state of Florida with cyanobacteria, we still haven't necessarily recovered from that event, where we had problems with the blue-green algae on the surface, and we had a tremendous flood shortly after that, which stripped all of our vegetation out of the river, and the nutrient loading that we're seeing in the Santa Fe River from land uses in the area has also increased the nutrient in the Santa Fe and has allowed filamentous algae to grow in versus the natural vegetation. So that quality of water, along with the quantity of water, is turning our being removed and extracted not only from the bottling plants, but from other industries, other land uses like agriculture, even human uses from municipality water resources, from city water. The extraction and the influence of nutrient loading has created an upside-down situation with our habitat in the river itself. So any amount of water being extracted, especially for a corporate grab, is a concern for the citizens that live and work around this particular incredible waterway that has these incredible springs that we want to protect for future generations.
Yeah, I don't know many students, particularly University of Florida, present and past, that aren't quite aware of Ginny Springs, and everybody is beautiful. It's a moment of passage, you might say. But it also, these springs, particularly the 32 gems, so to speak, but over 1,000 artesian wells, they give us a picture of the aquifer, which you just went through, and this is all the water water we got, even though Nestle says that they've got, hey, the sustainability water, they've got it totally on hand, and they not to worry, they can handle it. I am worried. And so it really is important, number one, that people really not only learn about this, but get involved. November has been thrown out that they're going to make a decision, but as I understand it, that isn't necessarily the case. But there will be a decision made, by who? The Suwannee River Management, Water Management? So what?
Yeah, I'm not sure where that November date came from, because we were told by the Suwannee River Water Management District, the water managers for our particular region of Florida, that it would be between October and the beginning of next year. The chances of it being on a November board, because it will go in front of their board members. They have a 9-member board panel that votes on these things. And interestingly enough, there's only 4 members on that board presently, because they have not replaced the 5 that they removed. They have not reissued the 5 members of the board that have been sitting on this board for years. The governor is, just like everywhere else at the water management district level, is replacing the board members with somebody, you know, some person who can sit on this board and rule over our waterways or our water resources. And so in terms of when this will come in front of the board, we are Santa Fe River, the organization that's worked the hardest to protect the Santa Fe and ultimately has stopped at least 4 bottlers from coming into this region. Years ago, we stopped them. They will definitely be getting the message out. You will hear about it for sure when it does come in front of the board. And we expect a lot of people in terms of public interest to be present and accountable and to speak for this issue. Now, ultimately, the what needs to happen is public interest. There's a portal. There's a water management district portal for this permit, Seven Springs Bottling Partnership. We would love the public to participate there. It's not a petition. It's not a social media thing. It is the actual government portal where they have to read every comment that comes in, and that link is provided under Action Alert on our Santa Fe River's website. But that is where the public interest needs to be making comments that are worthy of making the board and the staff members at the Water Management District take heed, take notice, and hopefully stop a permit such as this. That's a very effective public interest test. Speaking of tests, there's the 3-prong test that ultimately decides this permit. Number one, is it reasonable and beneficial? And how that gets interpreted can be interpreted in many different ways with the water managers. It can be interpreted for business or for us, the public. We want it interpreted for preserving and protecting nature and for making our livelihoods and our natural spaces better. So the other one is it in the public interest? And we've just already identified what that is all about. And then the third one are in this number, it's actually number 2, and then number 3 is does it affect existing users? That one is a really key one for my neighborhood, because all of us are on well water. So if you're talking about removing, which has never been done before, the 1,152,000 gallons a day.
A day.
You're creating a tone a day.
A day.
A day.
Yeah, I mean, that number just boggles my mind. Go ahead.
And you're creating a cone of depression in that region, and you have well water users on both sides of the Santa Fe River, including the system that it's being removed from, which is the Devil's Ear Complex. Devil's Ear Complex includes Ginny, includes Rum Island, includes Devil's Eye and Devil's Ear, includes July Springs, includes these really well-known Dogwood, includes Dogwood Springs, very significant springs, and you're creating a cone of depression in that region, you're going to see impacts. So existing users, not just Ginny Springs in the past in 1995 claimed that they were the only existing user, and they were the only ones that mattered because they owned roughly 400 acres around these bore wells. But the reality is, we know now, today, that our water all flows, it has a flow underneath the ground. And so you are going to be impacting other existing users. And I know for a fact that people have come to me and said, when that pump turned on in 1999, the pump at the bottled water facility, their water went down in their well. So when the pump turns on, supposedly other people are getting their water sucked into that bore well out of the ground. Now, when they tell me that, I tell them, go right into the portal, because that, their voice is going to matter in terms of existing users, because they are correct. They are identified address-wise, well, bore well, right in the same line as these bore wells that are being extracted for this bottled water permit. So existing users, in my mind, also are the other 22 million people that use this water. We're not the only ones using this fresh water. We're all using it, and we all need to be responsible and accountable on the surface, on the ground, on the land, on how much water we use, so we do not deplete the aquifer any more than we need to, especially when we're seeing 20-foot declines existing in the aquifer itself. So those are the three-pronged test is going to matter. Is it reasonable and beneficial? Does it affect existing users? And is it in the public interest? And those are the things that need to be written and addressed in the portal for the 20 River Water Management District.
And again, Marilee, Marwitz, Gibson, tell people how they can find that portal and more information, because if there's ever an issue that I think people need to get engaged and let their voices and their ideas be known, it is this issue. So again, go through how they can find that.
Sure. Go to the website, OurSantaFeRiver.org. And that is an organization. The complete name of it is Our Santa Fe River. And then you would look up Action Alert, or you could search the word Nestle. It's a wonderful tool that this website has daily news about water in the state of Florida, water that affects all of us, water issues. And so if you scroll down, you can find the Action Alert. And in there, it'll be a very, very clear way to actually put a comment into the Suwannee River Water Management District portal. And again, that's the permit for Seven Springs Bottling Partnership. You will not necessarily see this permit being listed as Nestle, even though Nestle is the one that ultimately needs to provide the science to even allow this permit to go through. They have not, by the way, provided the final request for additional information to even get the permit. That was issued in July of this year, and we're still waiting for that information to be shared with the Water Management District, which we'll ultimately read to. And the other part to this is they are still withdrawing the water out of this bore well daily. They could use up to the entire amount that we're talking about on this program, because the permit expired technically in June of 2019, but the way the laws and the rules and the regulations are written in the state of Florida, they are allowed to continue to use that permit until they finish the process of reapplying for the renewal and until it goes one way or the other in terms of a vote in front of the board. So we're at the mercy of this corporate entity who has more money than most corporations to provide the final word on the request for additional information, and they're dragging their feet doing so. They have not completed the information. They know that they can take all the water they want. They know that they can extend the permit for as long as they want. These are the way the rules and regulations are written in the state of Florida. They have got to be changed. Right now, nature is at the mercy of these corporate behemoths that allow that are allowed to extract our natural resources for profit and gain, with no mind, both this, at least in Florida, no mind to the state agencies that need to protect the natural resources. That was really what they were set up to do, these water managers, was to protect our water. And instead, they're doling out permits. This isn't the only one. We're doling out other permits, too. Agriculture uses millions of more gallons of water. So we're doling out permits when we should be ultimately protecting our water resources.
Well, Marilee Marwitz, I'm going to have to go on to the next interview, but please keep me informed. I'll be only too happy to bring you back to me. This is a critical issue. And Dr. Lynch, I'm really interested in green criminology, what you're doing at USF with your students. I think this is such an important area that we so desperately need in our society. So I'd like to bring you back, too, and maybe with some of your students, because to me, this, what future we're going to have, to me, this is the future we need. So to both of you, thank you so much. And people listening, remember that number, 1.1 million gallons per day. Do you think any spring or any aquifer could sustain that? Anyway, thank you so much to both of you, and do take care.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Wow. I tell you, people, the time is now. We either get involved and we do it, or we utterly lose it. And, you know, we do want to remember, no matter what Nestle says, we have all the water we're ever going to get. We really can't make or create it. And so we better take care of what we have, or 70% of our bodies are water. We don't do well without it. I'm going to put this music on and come back with Julie Kohler. To WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio, and this is From a Woman's Point of View, and I'm Mary Glennie, and I'm so happy that with me right now I have Julie Kohler. And Julie Kohler is a fellow in residence at the National Women's Law Center. She's a senior advisor at the Democracy Alliance. It's a progressive donor network, and her newest article, The Republican Party's White Women Problem, really I thought was quite fascinating. So, Julie Kohler, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mary. It's great to be back.
Well, it's great to have you. That, you know, we just got done. We're watching climate change, and we're watching what's happening. And, you know, to me, Julie, push has come to shove. You know, whether it's climate, Mother Nature, if you will, and I think people are seeing how she can strike back and will. But also, it's women. And you know that you're looking at the, and I think you've absolutely coined the perfect word right now, hostile sexism. It is. It's absolutely hostile. You look at these draconian measures that are being suggested for women's reproductive rights and their bodies, and you also look at the constant denial of any kind of inequity in pay, and you look at the, really, at this point still in this country, pretty pitiful representation of women in, you know, Congress and our governing bodies. And I think women, I've really reached a point that, and then you look at the absolute destruction that's going around us, and I think women have really realized that if they don't change their lives and things, nothing's going to change, and we just might lose it all. So I'm really glad to welcome you here.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and I've been, you know, really interested in women as a political force in the wake of the 2016 elections, and have been writing for a while on this topic, particularly of the swing in voting patterns among white women voters, because we did see a real sizable difference between 2016 and 2018. But equally interesting, and this is kind of what I focused on for this article, is, you know, we think of 2018 as one of the years of the woman, right? You know, where we saw this tremendous gain in numbers of elected women in elective office at every level. But really, it was the year of the Democratic woman. All of the gains were based on Democratic women being elected. And what we saw at the same time as all of these new Democrats coming into office was an actual decline in the number of
women Republicans in elective office. We've moved from 23 Republican women in the House to 13, with a couple more announcing that they're planning on retiring in 2020. The number of Republican women in state legislatures contracted in 2018. They lost about 50 or so seats. So I think it's a very important juxtaposition. And I was interested in the fact that there's been recently some energy and effort among Republican women to try to recruit other women to run for office and to try to provide them with early resources so that they could prevail in primaries. There was a test of this strategy, an early test in a North Carolina special election that was held, a special primary election that was held in July. And the Republican woman was trounced despite all of this this early support. Dr. Joan Perry lost by over 20 points. And the conclusion I've come to is that I think the Republican Party is going to have a hard time training and endorsing and recruiting themselves out of this predicament, that the trend is very much connected to this evolution we're seeing in women's voting patterns, and that we have to delve deeper into the substantive and cultural problems within the Republican Party.
Yeah, and you know, I was thinking when you were talking and thinking about the Democratic women we have in Congress now. And, you know, they're not only women, but you think of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Well, I'm thinking of the four horsewomen. Actually, I think of the restoration, if you will, of the renewal of this country, you know. And there are women of minorities, there are women of color. And this is what we were seeing. And, you know, that I think both Democrats and Republicans, I think, are having trouble actually with progressives, particularly with progressive women. But at least with the Democrats, you have all kinds of different groups. Now, how that's going to play out, I don't know. But with the Republicans, you have this entrenchment into white nationalism, into, you know, as you say, and I think it is so right, whether it's reflected in our president, it's such hostile sexism. You know, it's absolutely hostile to women, an absolute effort to control their bodies. And if they cannot control their reproduction, they do not have autonomy. And this denial that it's important for women, like with Dr. Perry, who ran against Dr. Murphy, and you really broke down that election well. And even though she ran as a Christian pro-life, that was not strong enough. And she was kind of concerned what was happening down at the border. She was concerned about the separation of families. And that showed her as too weak, that they could not trust her as a woman, particularly, to really stand for these dystopian policies.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one of the points I really delve into the article is that I think that the Republican Party now has, you know, kind of the cultural ethos is really rooted in this white male tribalism. And so it's the case in North Carolina that a number of voters, Republican primary voters, just didn't trust Dr. Perry to be hardcore enough. They didn't see her as sufficiently conservative, even though she ran on a very conservative, pro-life, you know, Christian agenda. And you mentioned this term hostile sexism. It's actually something that researchers have looked at, you know, kind of what are voters' views towards women, and what they found was that 2016 was the first year that you could predict how voters voted based on whether or not they held hostile sexist beliefs. So this is, we now have a Republican base that has coalesced very strongly around the president, right? I mean, Trump has about, what, 90% approval ratings among Republicans. He is enormously popular with the Republican base. And they are increasingly kind of organized or share or are characterized by holding these hostile sexist beliefs. And that combined with, I think, the attitudes around race and immigration and xenophobia are really creating this space where it's very hard for anyone but white men to prevail. And so I think you can send, you know, these new efforts, which I appreciate. I mean, I appreciate that there are women in the Republican Party that are saying, hey, it matters. Representation matters. But I think when you have a base that is ginned up on misogyny, that is ginned up on xenophobia and white supremacy, you're going to see have a very hard time prevailing in primary elections. And we saw that in 2018. Republican women won their primaries at significantly lower rates than Democratic women. So there is something among that base of voters that is not likely to be able to vote for women.
Yeah, and the polls, the recent polls have shown that white college-educated women, Republican women, went quite a bit in 2018 election. And also non-college-educated white women to a lesser degree, but they did too. And then they're finding that, you know, that about a fifth of all the Republican women are economically to the left in the sense that they approve of Medicare, they approve of Social Security. And, you know, we just got done talking about water and climate change on the prior interview. And to me, push has really come to shove, I think, politically in this country. And so when you watch this entrenchment, and whether it's trying to control women's reproductive lives, or as you talked in an earlier article that I don't know if you wrote it totally for Democracy Alliance, but you were talking about marriage fundamentalism. And that's a topic I'd like to get into too, because I think that really ties in to not only control, but economics, if you will.
Yeah, sure. So I think on the first part, you know, like, yes, I think the Republicans' problem is both cultural and substantive. And so I think it's kind of, you know, the cultural rootedness around this white male tribalism is alienating to many moderate and independent women, many of whom may have voted Republican in prior years. But then also substantively, I mean, I think the policies that have really come to define the Trump administration, including family separation and the horrific treatment of immigrants at the border, along with the draconian abortion bans and other policies, are also alienating. So you kind of have both substantively and culturally this base that just doesn't seem like a comfortable place for a lot of folks anymore. And what I refer to in the articles is it really seems like Republicans are in a bit of a political death spiral, that they have to increasingly cater to this narrowed base that is only likely to elect white men, that is then going to perpetuate the policies that then narrow the base further. And so I think it's that, you know, I mean, it's a tricky conundrum for Republicans. And it's not to say that, you know, Republicans cannot prevail in elections anymore. And we've certainly seen over the last many years that they have doubled down on voter suppression, on gerrymandering, on ways, you know, if they're not going to kind of change their brand to appeal to a broader base of people, they've tried to choose their voters by manipulating the electorate. And, you know, those tricks may work for some elections in the foreseeable future. But I do think longer term that it is quite a predicament for the party. And, you know, and I think the efforts that we're seeing, you know, by some Republican women to combat that are going to have a hard time really, you know, really gaining some traction.
And again, we're talking to Julie Kohler, and she's with Democracy Alliance. And real quickly, tell us about Democracy Alliance.
Sure. We are a network of progressive donors that really pools money in order to hopefully move our country in a more progressive direction and protect democracy. So we stand for both, you know, a stronger, healthier democracy and a more progressive future.
And, you know, Julie, that our world is drastically changing. And really, the challenges are, frankly, enormous. And we're talking real life here. And so we're talking life. We're talking death. We just saw the horrible Dorian in the Bahamas. And to me, that destruction was so devastating and will continue to be. And it was going up the coast. And you know, I'm thinking of Mother Nature and how we've despoiled her for centuries, really, and somehow just didn't care. But I'm also seeing the hostile sexism, the hostility to women and women existing and women being autonomous. And whether they're Republican or Democrat, that they see we're spending trillions on war when we need to be spending trillions on trying to save our planet, save our water, save our air. And you know that to do that, they absolutely have to have women. And you know that push has come to shove, that if they really feel they have to control women, what, because they are so afraid, or because women will reflect change and that terrifies them? I mean, in other words, I've kind of reached a point that the urgency is so strong, I can't wait for their reasons, that we just have to say, hey, we've got to do this because our lives are at stake. But I think it's really sad that, you know, it's like when the outside is burning down and there you've got somebody that's really worried about the construction, you know, of the chairs and the seating. And you sometimes find that sense of urgency, and there's almost this la-la land of not even wanting to recognize what's happening.
Yeah, you know, I've recently completed a number of interviews with women that were elected for the first time to state legislatures around the country, and many of them spoke about this, that, you know, several of them, they didn't even really anticipate that, you know, running for elected office or that politics was going to be their future, but they just felt that they couldn't stay on the sidelines. And I think we saw that across the board in 2018, that there were so many women that were just saying the stakes are too high. There is something so adrift in our country that does not reflect my values that I have to get involved. Like, I care too much about my community. I care too much about these issues. And, you know, the voices of my community members are just not being represented. I need to change that. So I think that was a hugely motivating factor. And, you know, it is interesting, again, like the Republican Party, the Republican Congressional Committee has said that there are record numbers of Republican women that are filing to run for office in 2020. And so, you know, I think that there probably are Republican women that feel that they would like to take their party back. And I, you know, have a lot of empathy for them. I would like to see that their party move in a different direction, that may not share the administration's values and really believe in kind of a different trajectory for the Republican Party. But I think it's going to be really tough for many of these folks to break through when you have a base that is fully in line and highly supportive of the president. So I think it's a really critical moment for what happens in the GOP, and I think one of the interesting conservative voices that I cite in the article was Jennifer Rubin, columnist for the Washington Post, who said really the only path forward is to basically, you know, burn it all down and build anew, that she doesn't even see that there's kind of a future in a Trump-led Republican Party. And I think there are conservative Never Trump voices that really do want to embrace a different vision, but it's not where the majority of the party is right now.
Do you think they're really afraid of women that much? Or are all the other pillars that they've heretofore believed in kind of disappeared, and so they have to cling to that because that's the only life jacket keeping them afloat in the body of water they've chosen to stay? I find this hostility to women, I find it kind of shocking.
Yeah, you know, and I guess I can't even pretend to imagine kind of the psychology behind it in individuals. And you probably have a different range of folks with different beliefs. But, you know, I think the bottom line is from a political standpoint, you know, and Democrats have a ways to go. Let's not kid ourselves.
Oh, absolutely.
Reflective democracy, you know, like we made some good, important gains in 2018, but there is still a long way to go. But the forces are that the party is really trying to evolve its elected leadership to more closely resemble its base and the diversity on many levels of that base. And you have the reverse, you know, sort of political incentives within the Republican Party, right? I mean, you are not catering to a very diverse base. And so to be reflective of
And Julie, I hate to do this, but I'm looking up at the clock and a minute has just gotten away. And so Julie Kohler, Democracy Alliance, thank you so much for giving us this time. You do take care.
Thanks, Mary. Great to talk to you.
Bye-bye. And you have been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. This has been From a Woman's Point of View. Just keep it tuned here all day, people. You need this kind of information.